This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Brian Fernandez and Joyce Goh, and the morning run begins. It's because Monday, it's a Monday, it's a wonderful Monday. It's the 9th of October, starting the week off. I'm very excited to be back.
Well, welcome back, Sharad. How was the Greece?
Greece was very good. It is the word, as you know. And I'm just quoting that song from the 70s, you know, that it's a play on words, of course. Joyce, you're nodding at me. I know you're much, much younger, so you might not know this classic musical, Grease.
Uh-huh. Ah, yes.
Yes, you
yes,
do.
I know it.
You do.
Welcome back.
Oh, well, you know, what is it to be back? After a long holiday, the first thing on my mind was, I want to be back at work. It's so exciting. Okay. No. Now, lots of stuff in the news, actually, not just from the weekend, but okay, what's actually happening now. The United States pummeled again by a major tropical storm. This is because after it pummeled many other countries in its wake, this is Typhoon Nate. I think it's killed 25 people in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Honduras.
Yeah, and it also has some implications, obviously, in terms of the economics of Mississippi, because it's one of the poorest states, after all, in the U.S.
Right. Also in the news, North Korea's Kim Jong-un has given his sister more power by promoting her to the nation's top decision-making body. Now, before we start raising the flag for women's equality, just to note that she takes the place of her aunt, No, who was not mauled by dogs to death or bombed into oblivion. It happened to one of the uncles, actually, if I remember correctly.
I think they used an artillery piece to blow him up.
Yeah,
right?
There were many rumors about how he was removed from power. But anyway, and this is one of the things that we're going to be talking about this morning, the gender pay gap, you know, women's rights and such. Does news like this, Joyce, excite you when you read of women taking leadership positions?
It depends on which position, but in this case, I guess, North Korea, and as you said, his sister, I'm not sure what to make out of it, and what is her decision, what is her position there, but hopefully she's a sensible lady, and she's able to make good decisions. If in that case, then great.
You know, I'm looking forward to the day that we have a madcap dictator who's actually a woman rather than a man. I believe at the moment only men have held that position. But who knows? There was Cleopatra, but then maybe the assessment on her rule will be quite different from others. Okay, also in the news over the weekend, the Inspector General of Police has ordered an internal inquiry into a video that's gone viral that purportedly shows 7 officers from his team, from his force, partying with a gambling kingpin at a Johor nightclub.
Ooh. I'm from Johor. Not surprising.
What's not surprising?
What's not surprising about this?
Well, a lot of things happen very, very openly in Johor. So news like this that isn't exactly something that's shocking.
Okay. Also related to the police force, we had this news over the weekend that the police department has sent several proposals to the government for consideration for budget 2018. We're coming up to budget, aren't we? Do we have a date on that?
27th October.
Oh, 27th of October. Mm. So very quickly, they say they want to enhance the functioning of the government's crime-fighting unit with these proposals. Now, we're going to be back with that gender story shortly. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Stuck in the Middle with You by Steeler's Wheel. Joyce Goh, Brian Fernandez, and myself, Sharad Kutin. Now, last year, Iceland's women, that's women folk, left work at precisely 2:38 p.m. to protest gender pay gap.
Yeah, so globally, women earn up to less than 50% of what a man earns. And so that's quite a significant gap. So even in Iceland, where it was supposed to be one of the best places in the world for gender equality. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. Now, one is, of course, many women perform lower wage-earning roles, such as teaching or caring for the elderly. They take time off to have children. They also do part-time work. So in response to this, especially this protest, Iceland has become the first place in the world to institute an equal pay for all based on a scoring system.
Joyce, this makes you very angry when you read about the fact that women get less pay for equal work. So we're talking about equal work, not
like different kind of work.
Job.
Right?
Yeah, but for, you know, does it make you angry?
Yes, of course. But I think it's a known fact, though, and it's sad. But I think we should try and work towards an equal system.
Have you found yourself in a situation where you're, you know, getting together with your sisters in the office and saying, hey, you know, we need to speak to the boss about this?
No, but I know of a situation where I know I'm paid less than someone that's of the same position.
And
as
is it kind of demotivating?
I'm not talking about currently, I'm talking about previously.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, because I'm sure you're the top earner in this office, in this team. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Brian, I know you're not a woman. I'm not a woman. We're listening, talking to Joyce here, who's a woman who's had to suffer this indignity of being paid less for the same amount of work that you're doing, right? Just because this other person happens to be a guy. I mean, does Iceland have any kind of solutions?
Well, yes, they do. So what they've done is this. They've mandated it by law, but they also came up with a solution in terms of a scoring system based on education, say physical strain of the job, mental stress associated with a certain job and a responsibility. Now, based on this, so it's like a balanced scorecard for individuals, like what would you do for a company? But then if the employer finds that somebody is doing an equal job and is paid less, it is the responsibility by law of the employer to equalize the pay. And I think that's quite a good solution to the problem because it ensures that really people, and I personally believe, there shouldn't be any differentiator between whether you're a woman or man. You should be paid equally for what you do.
Joyce, do you think that the problem is not a question of, you know, assessment systems or performance indices or metrics? It really has to do with the attitude of the bosses, who are largely men.
Yeah, perhaps it could be a culture thing as well. It's true. I think there's this glass ceiling where you can see in some a lot of corporations, you have a lot of women. Perhaps in the whole workforce, you have 50-50 men and women, but at the top, it's all men. You know,
yeah, it does seem that way.
It's that way. It is. I mean, I've covered a corporate, the corporate sector for so long, right? For over 10 years, right? And you see, most of them, they are all men. Even newsrooms.
Yes. And we're going to be talking about newsrooms shortly. But the question of the attitude of men. I mean, Brian, you know, you have been in business for a long time. Do you think that this attitude that where we can actually get women to work for much less pay just because everybody seems to accept it?
No, that's the thing. So it's something that never occurred to me until very much later. It never occurred to me earlier in my career. There was no awareness. I just assumed everyone was paid the same. But it's only my mid-30s that I realized there's actually quite a disparity in terms of salaries.
Do you think it's because when it comes to mid-30s, then children come into play? And when it comes to children, usually women will take that part of the responsibility and perhaps employers they prefer if their employees are around most of the time and not split between the children and work.
So I think they sometimes use that as an excuse. I think employers sometimes use that as an excuse. Oh, yeah, you know, so she's not so interested in her career.
Yeah,
she's interested in her family.
First. Yeah.
Yeah, and also the propagation of the species, right? I mean, this is the irony. So women are being punished for something that society demands of them.
Yeah,
which
is expected of us, women, right? Yeah.
So it's an extraordinary kind of situation. I do think that, you know, it's great that the laws are there. It's great that they have a kind of concrete way of assessing enterprises about equality. But really, there's something about the attitude of men, isn't there?
Yeah, so you see, this equal play law is a good thing in theory, and then the scoring system is also a good thing in theory. In practice, in a Malaysian contract, I have a difficulty in terms... I see a lot of roadblocks because of the bureaucracy, the methodology in terms of the ranking system, also the cost of execution. You've got to bring in consultants and stuff to do this.
Okay, we'll be back with more discussion about the media and where it's going shortly. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Joyce Goh and Brian Fernandez. Also in the news, and we were talking about this earlier, just briefly, the Wall Street Journal has announced that it will cease publishing the print editions of its newspaper in Europe and Asia. The reasons given, a loss of advertising dollars in the print version. The journal's parent company, News Corp, reported that ad revenues are down by some 12% in the last quarter. Now, of course, for journal readers, they can continue to access it via digital subscriptions that are available. But that wonderful feel of the newspaper and that newsprint, now that's all gone. Is this a story that's going to be happening over and over again, do you think, Joyce? I mean, just the nature of the media today.
Yeah, so sad. I actually was talking to Dr. Wong Sai Wan from, he's the EIC of Malay Mail. That's in a podcast. You want to listen to it, download the app to listen to it. And he's spoke about how the industry, he feels like it has shifted so much. And he said he thought it was a sunset industry, but he says it's dark now. And they have to look at the whole.
So it's beyond
digital
sunset now.
Yeah, yeah. He said it's dark now. It's pretty, yeah. He was really frank. And how they all have to look into the whole digital play.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, Joyce, I think it's not a Malaysian thing. It's not.
Yeah,
it's a global thing.
Yeah, correct. Yes.
And the key thing, the shift to paying for content will only happen if Google and Facebook decide that they can't afford to lose content providers and they start paying in some other different method.
They are looking into doing something like that.
Yes, they are.
Yes.
And I think some media is actually also trying to force this issue, basically getting the law on their side so that content creators get a share of the revenues that Google and Facebook take for granted. Mm. But there's another side to the story, which is the question of journalism and the fact that so they're closing down the print editions, but are they also going to cease having people reporting from those parts of the world? What are they going to rely on? And what kind of journalism are we going to expect?
Hopefully not, but they have to look at monetizing the whole digital platform, the whole digital play. I think a lot globally and locally, they have to look, media owners have to look at how they can monetize digital content.
Because right now, there's a real trick, hasn't it?
Yes, it's been tough to figure it out because there's just so many free news out there.
Yeah, not only that, Joyce, it's a broader picture of the business model itself. Printing a physical copy is expensive. So one of the ways that they are doing it is in a classic business fashion, which is basically, okay, I'm going to cut my costs. My biggest cost right now, besides people, is actually printing the physical paper.
Yeah, but aside from printing, is the ad revenue. Because ad revenue for print is still, like today in Malaysia, ad revenue for print, an advertiser paying for one page in the print will definitely be more than perhaps on digital, like a space, a box down there at the. So they have to figure out a way to charge
more. A banner, for instance.
Yeah, correct. They have to figure out a way to monetize that for the digital platform.
Yeah, many people, I think, who are not in the industry don't realize that their newspapers are not paid for by the cost of the newspaper price. It's really the advertising dollars that go behind it. And mm-hmm. that is the large,
that
the bulk
dropped.
Of it. Yeah. And that has dropped, right? Mm. So even if you keep paying for the physical copy, now if we actually had to cost what a newspaper is and in terms of how you pick it up, it might actually cost you quite a number of ringgit to pick up that newspaper. It was solely based on the subscription or the cost of the paper, the physical paper, right? And so I think that's part that people don't understand. A lot of people who consume the news assume it's always going to be there, and it doesn't seem that this is necessarily the case.
Yeah, but because the thing is this, the physical copy, and the Star has just increased the cost of their physical copy.
Yes, I came back from my little 2-week sojourn to find out the newspaper.
It's 10 cents more. Yeah.
And again, that's a revenue increase scenario. But you see, Joyce, I'm actually very positive long-term about the digital space in terms of advertising, because the more readership that you have, you actually can monetize it quite significantly.
Hopefully.
There are different ways of doing it.
Yes.
But, by page views.
But it's also what advertisers want. They no longer just want a passive ad there. They want people to click through.
They want to know how many eyeballs, who goes where, what the readers want.
They want to ensure that there's been a real material effect.
Yes, so ROI, whether there's ROI to their advertising, right?
And can that even happen in this day and age with the print media? Big questions. But first, Ragged Wood by Fleet Foxes, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Patched Up by Elvis Presley. According to our producer, Shazana Mokhtar, who's been to Graceland, Elvis Presley, a very good-looking man in his day. Now, of course, a long deceased. Speaking of patching it up, the region's economy has done very well. I mean, not just Southeast Asia, Asia as a whole. But the health of its employees apparently are in somewhat poorer shape.
Yeah, so this recent research by AIA Vitality Healthiest Workplace recent research report found that in Hong Kong, the average amount of time lost per employee per year because of absence or presenteeism, which is when the employee turns up but to work but not very, but they're not very productive, amounted to nearly 71 days.
71 days is extraordinary. What's that?
That's 2 to 3 months worth of lost time. And employees in Malaysia and Singapore lost an average of 66 to 54 days, respectively. And in Hong Kong and Malaysia, about 12% of the respondents reported symptoms of depression. That's around double the proportion of Australia, Singapore and the UK.
Brian, are you surprised by this these findings?
I think not so much so because, you know, there's so much pressure to, for example, come to work even though you're ill because of how your bosses will perceive you or how your peers will perceive you. So, for example, especially also when in tough economic times like this, companies are really stretched. So your headcounts are lower, you've got to multitask. There's a real pressure to come and perform. So, I mean, that's a lot of stresses there.
Speaking of pressure, the survey also found rates of bullying in the workplace in Hong Kong, Malaysia and Singapore were almost three times the UK's level.
Bullying.
Yeah, bullying in the workplace.
Yeah, I think that's because, you know, and that may goes back to our own very hierarchical system. Mm-hmm. It's based on social status and seniority.
Culture, these are
those things kind of add to that. But, you know, I'm surprised by the, actually one thing in this report surprises me is the word they give to being at work, but not actually working.
Yeah, presenteeism. Right?
I've never heard of that word.
Another thing that the survey found was while staff were contracted to work from 28 hours a week in Malaysia, okay, to 36.5 in Hong Kong, they work far longer in practice. So for Malaysia, like it's found that nearly 44 hours in Malaysia and in Hong Kong it's 48 hours. So you're contracted to work 28 hours, but you end up working like 44 hours.
Yeah, speaking of which, because they have in the media, and we've had this over the last couple of decades, that occasional story that comes out of somebody dying from overwork. And of course, Japan always seems to be the place that this happens. And we had a recent story of a public broadcaster, NHK, apologizing over the death of a young reporter who logged in some 159 hours of overtime.
But karoshi, or the term for death from overwork, is nothing new in Japan. It's been happening for years and years and years. But unfortunately, what's happening now is it's spreading across the region. People are dying from overwork. There have been bankers who have passed away in Singapore, for example, from overwork in the past. And I think, Joyce, you were telling me about stories in Malaysia as well of people passing away.
In Malaysia? Oh, no, I think that was Han.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah,
the question of how do you disaggregate those?
Yes.
So people can die of a heart attack. How do you know it's from overwork or
just bad lifestyle?
Heart
attack or stroke. You know, stroke and these kind of like depression, as the study has found. And the question is, why didn't they speak up? Do you think it's a culture thing? Like they're scared, like you mentioned, Brian, like they're scared to perhaps if they say something, then their colleagues or their bosses might
absolutely because
say
it's
you're
how
complaining.
You're perceived. You see, Joyce, it's a very clear thing about how bosses, for example, especially when we talk about bullying, how bosses perceive employees. It may not necessarily be productivity rated, but if, for example, the bosses see 10 people and they walk around the office at 7 o'clock and they don't see two of them, they then perceive that person to be not hardworking enough.
Right. Now, if you have that experience, you can always share it with us. Join the conversation. Tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899 and join the conversation. Because you can join the conversation at any point in the morning. Just tweet us. We'll come back with more after this. We'll be looking at healthier, happier people in cities. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Thinking About You, Baby. That was Batmobile. Batmobile's frantic music, BFM. You like that? Okay. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Brian Fernandez. Now, contrary to popular belief, busy city centres beat suburban living when it comes to human well-being. This is according to a study by Oxford University and the University of Hong Kong. The study noted that residents of higher density areas are more active, more socially engaged, less obese than people who live in the sprawl of suburbia. Now, to get more insights into this, we spoke to Hamdan Abdul-Majid, Executive Director of Think City, and asked him for his thoughts on these findings.
I think I will concur and agree with the findings of the study, because the reason why people move to cities is actually to locate closer to one another and to benefit from the presence of the different type of activities that are present, services, and also to be able to connect with different types of people. Over the last 50 years, there has been a big shift in terms of people moving away from the inner city to suburbs. The primary reason was one was with regards to people are looking for what you call better quality of life and so on, because cities were not effectively managed. Second was that jobs were shifting and we were in a stage where what you call the industrial sector was growing, and typically factories are located outside of the city. So the notion that people end up moving to what they call suburbs. But as the economy shifts and evolves, the relevance of city becomes important. As you can see from the outcome of the study, cities that have a bigger services sector will definitely see a rise in terms of people wanting to be in the city itself. And if you are living in the city, one, it reduces your commute. Two, if the city is well managed and taken care of, the quality of life will be pleasant and good. Three, you have more opportunities of amenities and services and so on. So these are things we see definitely are positive in terms of what the study's conclusion that came out from.
So if you remember, the study was done by Oxford University and the University of Hong Kong. And so we asked them naturally if these findings are applicable to cities in Malaysia.
I think it will definitely be applicable in Malaysia. Malaysia is also going through the trend where the economic structure is evolving and changing. Where our services sector is growing, and there's a younger generation of people who also want to locate. Both the younger and the older generation people want to be in the city. For the older generation, it's about being in closer to services and amenities. This is what we see in experience of developed countries. For the younger generation, it's about the new lifestyle trend where we're seeing that they are more present wanting to be in smaller, comfortable places as opposed to being in lavish big mansions and homes and so on. So definitely there's also a shift in terms of demand that we are observing. So Malaysia is no exception to it. The findings of the study will start to present itself in Malaysia. In fact, and we see this more and more also emerging in Malaysia.
Now, we asked Hamdan about the question of livability and whether Malaysian cities are achieving or any closer to achieving a healthier and happier environment.
I would probably say that it's not a glass half empty, it's half full. We have seen definitely how our cities are being reconnected through better quality of our public transportation networks. There's a lot of attempt to now to actually clean up and improve the infrastructure of the city, be it the pedestrian infrastructure, the what they call greening of the city and the delivery of urban services. So there's a lot of room, a lot of things have been done. But there's a lot more to be done in order to what you call to meet our aspiration to be as one of those top global cities.
So on the question of what ought to be done, what more can be done, we asked him what our current priorities ought to be.
It's hard to answer in generic terms, but each different cities have got different sets of challenges. For Kuala Lumpur, the pertinent priority is about enhancement of the connectivity and mobility. So I think that's one thing that's now being addressed. Two, it's about enhancing and renewing many parts of the city that have seen a decline. Three, we see there's a need to actually strengthen KL's character and identity, not only to be seen as a city that you go for employment and jobs, rather you want it to be a go-to destination and celebrating the young, celebrating what you call the old or the historical character and identity. So we see that there's a need for KL to strengthen its soul.
That was Hamdan Abdul-Majid, Executive Director of Think City. Because responding to the study done by Oxford University and University of Hong Kong, that people who live in inner cities actually are happier than those who live in the suburbs. Now, does that strike you as counterintuitive?
No, actually not at all, Sharad, because especially with young people, for example, if you're living in an inner city, there's just lots more things to do. There's shopping, there's restaurants below. If you look at things that have happened, for example, let's look at Melbourne as an example of how people have initially moved out into the suburbs, and then with the rise of all these apartments that were coming up in the inner cities, basically you had urban renewal, and then life started to germinate out of the inner cities again.
You know, Joyce, I mean, suburbs are known for their restaurants and for their malls. Yes. I mean, precisely. I mean, so maybe you don't go down your building and, you know, access it directly, but you can drive there, and that's what suburban living is all about.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I guess it's very subjective. It's up to the individual. If you live out, perhaps the environment's better, air quality better. It depends. Traffic.
As somebody, and both of you have children, now, you know, where would you be located? Would you, you know, following the study, say, yes, the inner city, you know, the dense, you know, congested, body-packed inner cities are a better place to bring up a kid, or would it be suburban Malaysia? I'm going to ask Joyce.
If we're talking about Melbourne, then suburbs. But in KL, then I guess city. Closer to where family is. Closer where my in-laws and my parents are. You know, the family.
But is it so far? I mean, would the commute be a deterrent?
But you see, here's the thing,
Sharad.
Traffic is the big issue in KL. So essentially then, like in my case, I live in the suburbs, and I think that for my daughter, for example, I think suburbia is much better because really the greenery, the little bit more space, it's nearer to the school. That really works. But if I was living, for example, in London, I'd want to stay right in the heart of the city if I could.
And where would you place your daughter?
Well, in a school nearby.
But because, you know, even cities, right, the dense part of the cities can have greenery. I mean, if it's organized well, if it's designed to be livable, you can have both, can't you, in many ways?
Yeah, because you see, and let's use the London example, for example, there's so many green lungs in the city.
Or Singapore.
Yeah, Singapore, Melbourne.
Singapore is really green.
So this is where we are lacking as a city, the green lungs. Everything has been just basically bulldozed away for development.
You know, I'm not so sure. You know, I take the MRT a lot, and all the over the street kind of tracks will show you a very green city. Kuala Lumpur is quite green, even in its inner parts. If you go down to where the museum is and where KL Central is, one patch of it is extraordinarily green. I don't think we've really killed off all that greenery, but maybe we're not as planned as Singapore.
Yeah, Singapore, everywhere you see, it's green and the air is fresher. But also perhaps traffic. Like I feel the congestion here, you can feel it. It's a bit more smoky.
Okay. Coming up next, the birds. Turn, turn, turn. And then, of course, we'll have the bulletin at 7 p.m. Sorry, 7 a.m. It's not. We're not reached to the other side of the day yet. Okay, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Joyce Goh and Brian Fernandez. Now, according to a terrorism expert, Rohan Gunaratne, Southeast Asia is seen as a hotspot for the growth of terror organizations. He's identified Sabah as one of the trouble areas in Southeast Asia, but also added the Philippines and Myanmar to the list. Now, his focus was the recruitment to terror organizations. We spoke to Ahmad Mohammadi, a political science and Islamic studies lecturer at the International Islamic University of Malaysia, and asked him what his thoughts are on Southeast Asia being a kind of strategic place to recruit and grow terrorist networks.
Yes, it is very interesting to see the spillover of the conflict in Syria in this region. Number one, it is because of the strategic interest for Daesh, because it holds the largest Muslim population outside Middle East. We have more than 100 million Muslims in this region, and definitely they can tap into support, expertise, they can tap into a lot of intangible benefit they can get from people in this region. Number two, we also have the existing hotspots in the whole of Southeast Asia. For example, in Southern Thai, now it is in Myanmar. And we also see the presence of militant group in Malaysia. in Indonesia. And then now, Professor Rohan mentioned there is a hotspot might be emerging in Sabah. So men exploiting these hotspots or the existing conflict is a strategy of Daesh in order to penetrate into this region, because they would say, you guys are sharing our vision, let us do it together. Number three is that in terms of infrastructure, you look at the banking system that this region provides, and look at the transportation. They can actually travel from the Middle East into Kuala Lumpur or in Singapore or in other part of Southeast Asia easily using the existing transportation system, using the facility to transaction of money from one point to another. And then the last one is that this region also the tourism friendly. Unfortunately, this policy of tourism friendly could be terrorist friendly too.
So we also ask him how sophisticated these terror operations are.
Yeah, there is a discovery recently. At least last year in 2016, the use of Bitcoin by Daesh as well as their followers. Not only that, actually, they also use a dark web in order to communicate, in order to share information, files, and so on and so forth. So the emergence of these practices, the use of Bitcoin to buy weapon, for example, to buy ingredient to make a bomb, and they use highly encrypted communication devices and techniques in order to operate. But I believe based on the information that I privy to, security agencies, at least in our country, they are very up to the standard and they are quite aware of what is going on right now. And I believe that our neighboring countries and also regional partners are also aware of that because they have this intelligence sharing arrangement.
Having spoken about the strengths that that they are in the counterterrorism space here, we did ask him also if there were weak spots.
There is some kind of space for improvement in our efforts to counterterrorism in this country. The glaring part of our counterterrorism strategy, something which is not really being done, is the lack of collaboration among the government's agencies. We have a lot of security agencies, for example, in this country, but from my perspective, they are working in silo at a certain point. They may cooperate, but maybe not collaborate. I believe that the way forward would be more on collaboration. To produce, for example, strategic assessment threats for Malaysia, and this document would be read by Prime Minister rather than read sources from different agencies. And they reach a different conclusion. I believe that there must be one single arrangement, which is, I think United States right now, they are doing that after 9/11, because they discover that one of the causes that led to 9/11 is lack of coordination, lack of collaboration between intelligence agencies in the United States. So right now they have a chairman for the security intelligence that share all information. They produce one single report, which is going to be read by the president. So I think that is something which needs to be done.
And finally, we asked him, how can the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, combat terrorism better?
The way forward to deal with the terrorism threat in Southeast Asia is, number one, is by tackling the existing hotspot. We need to help our partners in the region, for example, Philippines, Myanmar, and Southern Thai, so that we can reduce or we can cut off or deprive the terrorist organization from exploiting this conflict. And collaboration among regional countries also something which we need to look at. Each country is working in silo, and there is certain degree of intelligence sharing at the regional level between neighboring countries, between partners in the region, but collaborating proactively to nip the potential terrorism threat from growing, I think, is much more important rather than waiting the threat is coming to us, only then we can act or we are going to act. I don't think it's going to be a very effective way of dealing with terrorism threat, because one thing for sure, terrorism threat is growing silently. It doesn't grow on the surface. It grows below the surface. When it goes out, then it is too late already.
That was Ahmad Mohammadi, a lecturer at the International Islamic University in Malaysia, speaking about the comments made by terrorism expert Rohan Gairatne that Southeast Asia is a main source for recruitment and this is the future of terrorist organization networks.
I think there are two takeaways from that discussion, really. One was the fact that I'm quite surprised that the Prime Minister doesn't get a central document from all the various security agencies within Malaysia. I think that would really help coordination in terms of fight in the war on terror. The second thing that he also outlined, which is very clear, is I think greater collaboration within the region. Because this is a regional problem, I think that that's a key factor, sharing of information that we need to look at in more detail.
Yeah, it's scary how things he's saying that's not on the surface is below, that we do not know of. And he's talking about connectivity, how they can come into the countries here, the banking system, you know, things that is just everyday things, you know, that we take for granted. And they're using all these things and the dark web.
Yeah, I think also that, you know, finally it comes back to, you know, who is likely to be a recruit to these things. I mean, there's some people you just can't stop who might be attracted by these ideologies, right, of violence and political change through violence and such. But also the ground which makes these recruits, you know, makes the fertile ground on which this the terrorism grows really goes back to the question of social equality in the region. It goes back to social inclusiveness. I mean, the more you marginalized people. We have 800,000 people that have crossed over from Myanmar into Bangladesh. I mean, the recruitment possibilities there are huge. And that's because countries are dysfunctional. They're not democratic. They don't respect their citizens' rights. It's a real problem.
But also, Sharad, let's look at it locally as well. Our key challenges is also among the unemployed, the disenfranchised youth, because we've got a huge youth unemployment issue. Then we've also have an issue of course, people who've come back from studies in the Middle East who may have been already radicalized in the Middle East and then are fertile ground then to disseminate this sort of thinking across their friends.
But also what's fascinating is the number of top-notch terrorists in the region that Malaysia's provided, and they come from our institution. So recently in the Marawi city siege, we know that at least one of the operatives there for ISIS, it was a former lecturer at University of Malaya. I mean, this is not a man who's marginalized. He's not a factory worker who feels, you know, done by the system.
Yeah, what made them do that? That is interesting to find out why. Why do they do it? Why do they go there? Actually, Singapore also had someone. The Singaporean guy that is now quite high up in the ranks in these.
Yeah, so we've supplied bomb makers and such. Question is, why are we such a productive place for the creation of terrorists? It's a big conversation. We'll be back with more analysis after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.